Hello and welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast, the show about defence procurement and military technology. I am your host, Richard Thomas, and in this episode, we discuss the potential ramifications for defence from the US presidential election. It's worth noting that this episode is being recorded on Wednesday, 4th of November, and at this time, we still don't know who will win the hotly contested presidential race for the White House, as millions of votes are yet to be counted. So with results still expected from several key states, President Trump claimed an election victory, stating, quote, frankly, we did win this election, end quote, and saying that he would appeal to the Supreme Court to dispute the counting of votes. Quote again, this is a major fraud on our nation, he stated during another speech. In a comment on election night, the Democrat candidate Joe Biden stated, quote, I believe that we are on track to win. So with all that said, as we all wait to see who will achieve the 270 votes needed to win the presidency, in this episode, we want to bring together our team of journalists and editors to discuss the influence and impact of the results on the defence sector, policy implications for the US military, and the potential effects of the result on European defence and relations with NATO countries. We'll also give you a different perspective in conversation with a former US Army Lieutenant General who now works as Director of the Heritage Foundation's Center for National Defense. But before we dive into all of that, let's take a look at what's been making the headlines elsewhere in the world this week. And to Japan, where the MOD has picked Mitsubishi Heavy Industries to lead the effort to produce the FX-6 generation fighter jet. As prime contractor, Mitsubishi is expected to work with a foreign partner with strong contenders, including BAE Systems, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Northrop Grumman. Interoperability with the US is expected to be high on the priority list for Japan, a country which has already committed to buying 147 F-35 fighters from the US, but the FX platform will be a clean sheet design, so we'll have to wait and see. In Australia, the Blue Bottle unmanned surface vessel is to conduct a series of tests next year that will enable it to carry out a wider series of tasks for the Royal Australian Navy. A fleet of five Blue Bottles will operate as part of a networked squad that will undertake three different roles in a diverse area of operations. These include guarding assets such as ports or oil rigs, EEZ patrols, and apparently undertaking anti-submarine warfare operations. Tests in July this year proved the use of 360-degree cameras, radar, AIS, and collision avoidance software during autonomous operations. In Russia, military scientists from the 38th Research Test Institute for Armored Equipment are promoting the idea of a twin chassis main battle tank to replace the Armata T-14 in the 2040s, but this may prove to be overambitious. Twin chassis tanks have a long history but have never moved beyond the experimental stage. Meanwhile, the Armata is experiencing production problems and is still undergoing trials, which calls into question the proposed timeline. In the UK, the Ministry of Defence has declined to share a specific date for publication of the forthcoming Integrated Review of Security, Defence, Development and Foreign Policy. No specific date was given by Ben Wallace, Secretary of State for Defence, during a 2 November parliamentary oral questions session. Instead, he said that the implications of a one-year spending review, set to be completed by 25th of November, are currently being considered. The new spending review, led by the UK Treasury, will set the 2021-2022 resource and capital budgets for individual government departments, but a single-year settlement runs counter to the multi-year funding assumptions behind the integrated review. And these were some of the headlines. If you'd like to find out more on these and more stories from across the air, land and sea, please do visit our website, shepherdmedia.com/news. So now it's time to bring into the show the rest of the team to provide their thoughts on US defence policy in light of the election. So a warm podcast welcome to news editor Ben Vogel, air editor Tim Martin, and land reporter Flava Camargos Pereira. Hello to everyone.
Hi there.
Hi, Rich.
Hello.
Ben, your thoughts on US elections and, you know, impacts on the defence sector?
As you said in the introduction, Richard, so much is uncertain at the moment, but perhaps it's worth going into a little bit of detail on policy discussion in terms of naval procurement and program planning. I'd wonder, as you were the naval editor, you might be able to sort of give a little bit of insight into the plans to build a massive US Navy even beyond the 355 ships that were envisaged previously. It seems that under the Trump administration, the Secretary of Defense was looking to build a 450-plus U.S. fleet. But how can this be achieved even if Trump ends up winning a second term?
It's a fair question. With a great deal of difficulty and a lot of aspiration, but the reality might be somewhat different. I mean, obviously, you're referring to this Battle Force 2045 document that Mark Esper outlined in September, calling for a 500-strong fleet by that date, comprised of manned and unmanned vessels. So that 355-ship fleet that the Trump administration called for in 2016 is but the first waypoint to this, as you say, this much larger force that the DOD thinks and sees the US Navy requires in order to combat a Chinese Navy that's already far bigger than it, effectively. So it's a really interesting document to read. Aspiration is high, as I say, but the practicalities are probably somewhere short, particularly with regards to unmanned vessels, because it's one thing calling for an increase in the number of unmanned surface vessels, subsurface unmanned vessels, to act as anything other than sensor nodes. Combat operations, unmanned combat operations at sea are a long way behind what we've seen in the air domain.
And while the Biden campaign hasn't specifically sort of taken aim at US Navy procurement plans, the presidential candidate, Joe Biden, did talk about the need to replace legacy manned or crewed platforms with more unmanned technologies and smart systems, partly as a means of being a little bit more cost-effective when it comes to procurement and sustainment. In terms of the Navy, Richard, I mean, there is a move, isn't there, already to increase the proportion of unmanned vessels or unmanned technologies in the US Naval inventory. So how do you see that kind of panning out?
Oh, I'd kind of refer myself to my previous answer, really. I mean, as I say, yeah, you might want to have unmanned systems integrated into the whole battle force, but at the moment, all they can safely do is have sensors on them that can be integrated into the wider naval network. I mean, that's a definite use case that could be achieved within a very short space of time, within 5-10 years. But no, unmanned operations, if you're looking at interdicting surface threats, subsurface threats, that's a whole different kettle of fish. You've got all sorts of operational practices and doctrine. UNCLOS, for example, you have to adhere to that. So that's a tricky one. Other kinds of technologies, though, that the US Navy could integrate and can is, yeah, you want an increase in cyber capabilities. You need more hardening. AI, absolutely. I was talking with you about this in the Naval webinar that's being published on, what, the 6th of November, that can see a CMS performing much of the functions in terms of detection, tracking, selection of the correct deterrent to meet or match a specific threat, being done autonomously or by machine learning, leaving the human operator to just enact the action, as it were. So those kind of technologies absolutely can be integrated. It would improve the capability and response time of naval platforms, not just US Navy, but every naval platform.
So I was just going to jump in and add there, guys, just in terms of naval aviation. As I've said before, there does seem to be some dispute or some difficulty in thinking about how many unmanned assets would be deployed from aircraft carriers. And I think there is a sense that the Navy aren't overly keen on that idea. As I've said, on the Loyal Wingman, for example, if there's 40 or 50 that you want to move quickly, how is that going to happen? Yeah, it's just my thoughts, I guess, on the aviation side when it comes to those types of questions.
Agree, and that's coming from a domain that is effectively comfortable in using unmanned systems and, you know, quite comfortable in having manned, unmanned teaming operations. So you translate that to the naval domain, and the Navy side has to do all the lessons learned that the air side had to do over the past generation before they get to a point where they can effectively deploy unmanned systems in a combat role.
And speaking of aircraft carriers, as Tim did just now, there's already some debate within the DOD under the Trump administration about whether to build a force, a fleet of light carriers in the future, or to continue along the road of replacing the Nimitz-class nuclear-powered carriers like for like with the newer Gerald R. Ford class carriers. Yeah. So again, you know, we're looking at this in the context of the US election. If Trump ends up getting a second term, and that kind of thinking might gain traction.
It might gain further traction, of course, if the other side wins and Biden becomes president, then of course the Secretary of State for Defense, or the Defense Secretary, I should say, won't be Esper, because Esper is Trump's man. So, but yeah, I mean, this idea to potentially introduce light carriers into the US carrier mix is Esper's idea, part of this Battle Force 2045 idea. And yes, it does say maybe you might need to build fewer Ford class. I think it was 8 to 11 Ford class. And say up to 6 light carriers, which, as we talked about previously, would be based on probably the America class. But again, that's all aspirational thinking. There's an awful long way to go. And, you know, the build time for these Ford class means that whichever candidate becomes president, they won't have to make a decision anytime soon, because you've got probably a couple of decades before they need to really start thinking whether to curtail the Ford class and introduce some lighter style carriers, to be honest.
In terms of planning timelines, there has been some more kind of urgent, perhaps, or near-term work being done under the Trump administration on modernizing the U.S. nuclear triad, trying to modernize and upgrade or replace various aspects of that. Has there been any kind of comments from Joe Biden on the stump about what he would do with the U.S. nuclear arsenal?
Yeah, well, in a PBS interview in September, he said that he would look to scale back on spending on U.S. nuclear capabilities. But really, just looking at it from the naval domain, I don't see how you can reduce investment into the Columbia SSBN build, aside from the fact that it's quite closely tied with the Royal Navy's ambitions for the Dreadnought class. An SSBN is probably the most effective option you've got for the deployment of a nuclear strike capability.
And that's the Trident 2D5, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't quite see how you could possibly reduce spending on the nuclear on the US nuclear triad, because those are cornerstones of US defense policy. It would be a seriously big shift, because then you're not talking about necessarily having the first strike nuclear capability. You might be looking at second strike, and I don't think any president can make that argument stick to the public.
And there's already actual physical construction work underway on the new ground-based strategic defense facilities that's actually underway in America at the moment. It'd be quite hard to turn that around, I expect, if Biden wanted to. In terms of legacy systems, I mean, as I mentioned earlier on the stump, Biden was talking about moving away from traditional platforms, focusing on unmanned and cyber, artificial intelligence, all the newer things, all the 21st century forward-looking kind of technologies, rather than looking at legacy tanks and ships and things like that. I mean, that kind of comment, that kind of talk's been around for a while, not just among politicians. But how realistic in this day and age right now, 2020, looking ahead, how realistic is that to achieve, would you say, in the States?
If the question is, can cyber replace the kind of effects that hard equipment can enact during times of conflict or war, then no, it can't do that. Cyber will always be a necessary capability for a manned or unmanned platform to have. What you obviously want to make sure is the platforms you have are secure enough that they won't be spoofed, they won't be taken control of, as of course in the air domain, Iran managed to do that quite successfully with the RQ, I'll get this wrong, 17 something. But yeah, I guess moving to the future, I mean, it's even current now that Navy's industry in particular looking to push this idea of this cyber secure platform to allow a vessel to operate independently outside of you know, global communication networks if it has to do so in a contested environment. So I think obviously that's where the whole cyber thing comes into play. You know, as has been said in, you know, UK corridors of power recently, this notion of cyber and scrapping hardware is an easy argument to make for people who don't really know what they're talking about, frankly. Okay, thanks Ben for those questions. On that cheery note, I'm going to throw the grenade back into into Tim's court. So what kind of outcome might you think, or might you foresee, let's crystal ball it, might you foresee from an election result for Trump or for Biden? And also, how has the air domain fared over the past 4 years during the under the Trump administration?
Yeah, I think to start with Biden, it's interesting that in some respects he's been characterized, as a socialist, as a bleeding heart liberal and things like that. But I mean, he does have connections directly to the military. His son Bo fought in the Iraq War and was there in Iraq for a year. Subsequently, tragically, died from cancer. But Biden took real exception to an idea back in September when they were having a presidential debate and where controversy kind of surrounded comments from Trump when he suggested that military men and women were kind of losers and suckers, to quote him. And I think, the gloves were off from Biden when that comment was made, and it did hit an emotional spot and it did trigger something from him, because he did go on to reference his son. So I think that's a little sort of, I know it's an anecdote, but it is evidence that he has strong feeling when it comes to military and defence. And it's a bit wishy-washy to maybe suggest it, because the Democrats have previously suggested that they would cut funding, that's going to be a natural progression if Biden was to become president. So I think, though, there will be some tougher decisions if he is to become the new president when it comes to the air domain, particularly around sales to the Middle East of fast jets, because we know that because of the Abraham Accords, in particular, this normalization of relations between Israel and the UAE and Bahrain have effectively led to Trump approving sales for the UAE. And I think there is a real difficulty in simply suggesting that because there is an alliance between the US and the UAE, that partnership and those sales are, going to run smoothly, because it shouldn't be forgotten that the UAE stand accused of war crimes in Libya, and there's human rights organizations who are flagging that particular issue. And that all seems to have got lost in the weeks since the Abraham Accords have been signed. So whether Biden takes a dimmer view to all of that, I suppose, is open to interpretation. We don't have anything concrete to get a read on that, but certainly it's something that he will have to consider. Yeah, I don't think that the reports recently that have suggested that these arms sales are going to go through are as cut and dry as they might appear, particularly if Biden does become president. On the same note, if it's a second term for Trump, then absolutely expect those things to be pushed very hard, and expect those sales to lead to subsequent deliveries and things like that. The other thing to consider in all of this is there will be Israeli opposition. At the moment, there appears to be kind of an olive branch being given to the US, suggesting that they'll provide F-22s for Israel, possibly, and also bunker buster munitions. So that might be a policy of an appeasement here, and maintain relations as best they can with allies in the Middle East. But I think that's certainly something to watch. As regards kind of longer trends when it comes to air power, I don't suspect there'll be any huge changes in terms of long-running programs, particularly with fourth, fifth generation combat jets. The Army have their rotary FVL program kind of running fairly smoothly. You can't imagine that something like that would change, because the real priority is to make sure that those new aircraft are much more capable than the legacy aircraft, and with an eye on what China and Russia are doing. So, all of that would make, to me, seem like there'll be consistency across the board, whether that's with a Biden presidency or whether that's a second term for Trump. I would flag, though, not specifically or related, but the US and Russia at the moment are negotiating the New START treaty with Russia. And that expires in February 2021. And the bottom line on that is that both are committed to a limit of, I think it's 1,500 nuclear warheads. And so with a Trump presidency, you might expect a bit more of a hard line, whether you get an extension to that that's only 1 year or 2 years, again, open to interpretation. But with a Biden presidency, you know, where would that go? Would he go for an extension of 5 years? Would China possibly be included? Something like that. There's the kind of bigger questions that might need to be answered sooner rather than later. But as I say, that isn't strictly speaking on the other side.
So effectively, what we have is the notion that Joe Biden, despite being a Democrat, would be somehow soft in foreign policy or wouldn't support the US defense forces and the industrial base is pretty wide of the mark. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's an unfair characterization. We have to give him, you know, 6 months in office or a year perhaps to kind of, you know, to find out if there's any truth to it. But that would be my reading of it.
Good stuff. Thanks, Tim. And thanks, Ben, for your comments. We'll be back with more on the land domain and our chat with the Heritage Foundation after a short break. Stay with us.
We are falling further and further behind. Word documents are not far from handwritten letters passed in the Civil War.
Now the challenge is, well, how do you do that if you don't have your centralized command and control, if your logistics are contested, if your communications are being jammed? Adversaries have figured out our game plan and are engineering asymmetric ways to interfere with that whole system.
In the chaos of combat, warfighters need fast, secure communications and instant access to information. However, the digital information age we know today has changed the nature of warfare across all domains. Military commanders are acutely aware that new networks, systems, and technologies are needed to ensure timely and effective communications. This is Shepherd Studios' podcast series on Five Eyes connectivity, sponsored by our partner, Viasat. In Series 1, we looked at connectivity issues facing the Five Eyes grouping of countries. For this second series, we're diving further into these issues, speaking to senior military leaders about the work underway to ensure military communication networks can withstand the expected threats of tomorrow. In this opening episode, we look at the connectivity issues facing the US military and its further development of the multi-domain operations concept. Many of the technological and operational advances that will be demanded in the JADO battlefield are aspirational, and there's a chasm between today's reality and long-term goals. How can the US and its allies make this transition? To learn more about Shepherd Studios' podcast series on Five Eyes connectivity, a link will be provided in the show notes. Until next time.
And welcome back, Flavia. Politically, the US is hanging in the balance, but either way, it looks like the US Army still has a few issues at stake. So take us through those.
The US Army is running a program to replace the Bradley fleet. The US Army issued a draft request for proposal in July, and the tender is expected by 2021. At this point, it seems that this program will be a priority because this is the fourth attempt to progress with the plans to replace the Bradley fleet. And initially, the OMFV was planned to be introduced in 2026, but this process had a lot of changes. And currently, it's set to enter service with the Army from 2028. And at this current process, the service changed its procurement strategy, and the requirements of this platform in the previous competition, they were extremely ambitious. But in this current process, the Army has invited the industry, the companies, to take part in the process. And the information gained from the industry feedback will be used to shape a final request for proposal, as well as a competitive tender. And this approach focuses on encouraging innovation and maximizing competition. And in this case, the Army intends to access innovative approaches in many areas with this new platform. It includes survivability, mobility, growth, lethality, weight, logistics, transportability, manning, and training. In this sense, the OMFV will improve the arms capabilities and will add capabilities that the Bradley doesn't have and doesn't provide. And the OMFV will be able to maneuver in multi-domain operation. And it'll be a flexible platform, able to network with other capabilities on the battlefield. And in this sense, also, the branch is looking for an open architecture for the OMFV. In this sense, this platform will be able to receive upgrades and to incorporate future capabilities. So it seems at this point that the OMFV will be a priority for the Army. I think it doesn't matter if Joe Biden is the next president. Actually, it won't make a huge difference in the process, because at this point, it seems that the Army will move ahead in the next coming years, especially due to the service commitment with modernization. So at this point, the Army is likely to progress with this program, especially because it fits quite well in the service future plans, including to have, especially to related to have unmanned and optionally manned platforms.
Well, the attempt to replace the Bradley is obviously the various programs, cancel programs, and the restarts have, you know, transited both Democrat and Republican administration. So I guess whether Biden wins or Trump wins, this is a replacement or a capability that needs to be integrated at some point to the US Army. But I mean, you said it's the fifth iteration or the fifth time that the force has tried to replace this platform. What's to say in a year's time, in 2 years' time, we're not asking you the same question and they're saying this is the sixth iteration or the seventh or the eighth time they tried to replace the Bradley? What confidence, honestly, do you think you can have in this program actually being completed?
Actually, I think the main point now is the Army adopted a new approach. So it may give the Army new possibilities and the possibilities to have the platform that will fit in the Army's future plans, to have enhanced capabilities, to have a platform that could be networked with other platforms on the battlefield that had improved communication systems, improved capacities. So at this point, I think this would be a priority for the Army in order to keep the arms capabilities ready for the battlefield of the future. Because at this point, Bradley, it doesn't provide what the Army expects in terms of future. So at this point, if the Army doesn't move ahead with the OMFV, they will face serious challenges in the future.
Yeah, another area that the US Army has fallen behind its peer and near peer competitors in is sort of artillery and long-range fire support. We saw in Ukraine just how effective, let's say, Russian supporting fire was in damaging severely Ukrainian armoured assets. So how's the US Army looking to catch up, looking to match, I suppose, the capabilities that Russia and China can field. There's an awful long way to go in that sector, isn't there?
Yeah, I think it seems to be a priority for the army in the next coming years as well. And the U.S. is likely to maintain its effort to improve the air and missile defense and the long-range precision capabilities. Actually, the Army is planning to improve its inventory with a series of new long-range precision fire systems, and they will replace the aging inventory of the Army tactical missile system capability. And the focus is to address and to overcome both Chinese and Russian capabilities, especially related to long-range precision fires. Both China and Russia, they have filled artillery with long ranges in the last few years, and they had expressive results firing these capabilities, showing these capabilities. In the case of the Russian army has already demonstrated that its capability to find and to destroy targets with long-range fires. And China is expanding its inventory of long-range rockets and missiles. And both Chinese and Russian military postures challenge the U.S. interest around the world, including early this year, Mark Esper, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, said that China and Russia were challenging America's leading the military technology. If Biden is elected, we actually can't expect a huge change for the army related to air missile defense and long-range capabilities, including because in his campaign, Biden said he doesn't foresee major reductions in the U.S. defense budget in order to overmatch China and Russia. So it seems that to face Chinese and Russian capabilities will be a priority. And in this sense, long-range precision fires and air and missile defense will continue being priority as well. The U.S. Army long-range precision fires program will allow the service to attack, to neutralize, to suppress, and destroy targets. It'll be an all-weather precision surface-to-surface deep strike capability. And these fires, the long-range precision fires, will be able to reach targets farther than 300 kilometers and will provide field artillery with long-range and deep strike capabilities. Also, they'll be used to support brigades, division corps, the Army Joint and Coalition Forces, and Marine Corps Air-to-Ground Task Force as well. In, like you were saying, in addition, actually, it seems that the U.S. long-range fires can also benefit NATO. Some of NATO members they lack sufficient countermeasures to face Russian capabilities. And because of this, they could become a target. So in this scenario, due to the U.S. international plans in terms of politics, international relations, and also due to the U.S. Commitment to NATO, it seems that the long-range precision fires and the missile defense, air and missile defense, are likely to continue being a priority for the Army.
Yep, thanks, Flavia. I mean, I think from the conversation that we've just had across all the domains, there's probably going to be broad support, no matter who wins, for indigenous industry and manufacturing capabilities. I think one of the interesting things that we can draw out from this, and Tim, you made an excellent point, is what impact a potential change in presidency will have on exports and that whole geopolitical aspect to the defense sector, which is often not really talked about, but always underlines it. Okay, thanks everyone. Coming up next, Tim Martin talks with the former US Army Lieutenant General, or Lieutenant General, and now Director of the Heritage Foundation's Center for National Defense, Thomas Spoer, about the similarities and differences potentially between Donald Trump and Joe Biden's defense priorities. ¶¶
And if you roll right the way back to that sort of 1950s, 1960s, early 70s, the UK was really at the cutting edge of space and space launch and every aspect. And now we're getting back there again.
How do you weigh lunar sample in a weightless environment? How do you test for water on the tip of a drill bit on the moon when you're back on Earth? Our ability to be part of that programme is absolutely fascinating.
The UK space sector has seen rapid development in recent decades, with a total income of about £15 billion and generating more than 40,000 jobs. The industry and its government partners have identified significant room for growth in the coming years, fuelled by domestic investment and international programmes. However, the sector faces a number of challenges. How can it recruit the people it needs when there's a widespread shortfall of STEM-focused employees? How can it support education across the board, from primary level to university students? And what will be the impact of leaving the European Union? Welcome to episode 2 of the Defining the Future podcast, Shepherd Studios series on aerospace and defence innovation, sponsored by our partner Raytheon UK, a company invested in Britain, creating British jobs and supporting local communities around the UK. To learn more about the transformation underway across the UK space sector, listen to the Defining the Future podcast, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm thrilled to say that I'm joined by Lieutenant General Thomas Spohr, Director of National Defence at Heritage Foundation, a think tank in Washington, D.C. As we continue our election, U.S. election coverage, we're going to focus on some of the defence implications that might result from either a new presidency or a second term for Donald Trump. Lieutenant General, thanks very much for joining us, and you're very welcome to Shepherd Media Weekly Defence Podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Yeah, I think it's probably worth mentioning that as we're recording, there's still no conclusion, and we're still none the wiser as to who might be the next president of the United States, or if indeed Donald Trump will be given a second term. But with that said, and if we look into the possibilities of both those potential scenarios, what would you say are the main differences that come to mind when we think about defense policy of the Republicans and the Democrats?
Yeah, so thanks again. I think there are a lot of similarities, and we can talk about those. The main differences, I would say, is there is a lot less enthusiasm in the Democratic Party in a Biden administration for growing the defense budget, you know, and so they have in the last two Congresses they put forward proposals to cut the defense budget one by 10%, which is a lot of money. You know, defense budget, U.S. defense budget's around $700 billion, and so a 10% cut, while it doesn't sound that big, that'd be $70 billion, and so that'd be a fairly significant cut. A couple other areas kind of where they're very different, and that's in nuclear modernization. The U.S. nuclear deterrent has essentially gone unmodernized for about 20 or so years. And so it's all the legs of the nuclear deterrent, the sea leg, the land leg, the air leg, bombers, subs, ICBMs are all kind of due for modernization. And the Biden administration is a lot more skeptical about the need to do that, and so they would potentially go slower. They might even, they've talked about trying to forego one of the legs of the nuclear triad, like the ICBMs. Another area where there'll be a lot of differences is in policy difference. And so this, the Trump administration has put in place a policy about service by transgender individuals. Vice President Biden has kind of said that on day one he would overturn such a policy. So there's a lot of areas where they differ. Some areas where they're fairly similar is both President Trump and Biden are kind of skeptical about overseas commitments of U.S. forces, which is kind of significant, is that they both kind of share that view.
Yeah, and just as you mentioned, then the possibility of funding cuts if indeed Joe Biden is elected. I mean, where might the axe fall then, aside from the nuclear deterrent issue that you've mentioned and raised? I mean, across our land and sea, where might the axe fall on big programs in particular?
Yeah, and so there's been some discussion among people that were in the previous, in the Obama administration, about maybe cutting the size of the U.S. Army. The Army has been, it's at around 485,000 active duty soldiers right now. Some people that, you know, for example, Michelle Flournoy, who's, you know, talked about as being a potential defense secretary in a Biden administration, have talked about shrinking the Army because there's less need, you know, if you're in a conflict with China, to have a large army. So they've talked about that. Obviously, the nuclear deterrent is one. Some discussion about, do we need as big a Navy as the Trump administration has projected? You know, the Trump administration recently talked about growing the Navy up to 500 ships by the year 2045. Some, like Hillary Clinton and others, Adam Smith, the current chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, have questioned that number. So I think there are some areas where cuts could happen. And then just in conventional fighting systems like tanks and aircraft carriers and jet fighters like the F-35, I think the Biden administration would be a little more reluctant to buy those in the quantities that the Trump administration has projected.
Mm-hmm. I mean, on that topic then, I mean, industry would presumably be fairly nervous then about a Biden administration, if the reading on this is that there are potential cuts to come, and that he and that the Democrat Party in general are at least sticking to the levels of funding that you know, have gone ahead under Trump. You know, what would the sense from industry be on then the next 4 years if the country is to be led by Biden?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, most of the major U.S. defense industries just had their third quarter earnings call, where they talk about their forecast and how they did for the year. And they've all essentially put a good face on it. So nobody, none of them are projecting gloom and doom under a Biden. And because they were all asked, how do things look under Biden? And they have said, not so bad. You know, we're not terribly pessimistic. I think that's their public face. I think in private, if they were asked, they'd be relatively concerned about a Biden administration and where it would go in the defense industry. There is a normal moderating factor, and that is jobs and industry. And so, especially in areas like the shipbuilding industry, there's, you know, the Biden administration would be somewhat moderated by the impact that these shipyards that are sprinkled on both of the coasts generate a lot of industrial jobs, and people are, you know, traditionally very reluctant to cut industry manufacturing type of jobs. And not only just the shipyards themselves, but the secondary producers, you know, the companies that make propellers and engines and all those kinds of various things that go into ships, you know, throughout the heartland of the United States. Again, that acts as a moderating impulse on people that would say, hey, we need to cut ships or planes, that type of thing, because those immediately translate to jobs. And Democrats are just as sensitive to the, you know, allegation that they have cut U.S. industrial manufacturing jobs. Nobody wants to be accused of that.
And if we move the conversation slightly to look at international partnerships, I mean, throughout the last 4 years under Trump, there has been a sort of sense that when it comes to Europe, it's becoming an uncomfortable partnership insofar as he's continues to accuse NATO partners of not doing their part in burden sharing, which is, of course, meeting 2% of GDP for defence spending, which, you know, in some respects is absolutely fair, because there are various European partners who aren't up to the mark on that. But there's also a sense of isolationism coming from him also, insofar as pulling troops from Germany in particular recently. And then also when it comes beyond Europe, then the Abraham Accords, which have recently been signed and which have normalized relations between the UAE, Bahrain and Israel, has led to expediting sales of F-35, and we're seeing potentially F-35s going to go the way of the UAE and Qatar, you know, which would be the first in the region beyond Israel having them. And of course, the whole sensitivity around that is that there is an agreement with Israel on the US behalf to maintain their military balance. So when you take all of that into consideration, I suppose there would be plenty of potential changes or things to think about, at least on an international front, that the Biden administration would have to weigh up. And would it be your reading that there would be consistency along those lines with Republicans throughout the last 4 years and for a further 4 years? Or what would you read into all of that?
Yeah, great question. So in terms of the NATO partners, you know, it's this discussion about people need to pay, contribute militarily to the alliance has been, you know, a theme for at least 10 years or so, but it's always been conducted very much more low key. And so, you know, secretaries of defense under President Obama, for example, would go to Brussels. They would raise these matters behind closed doors at the NATO ministerials, and it would never make the front page of any kind of news. And that's the difference that Trump has brought, is that he has no reservations about bringing these issues up in the most public of ways, even, you know, in the communiques that flow from these NATO meetings and things like that, and talking about it in the U.S. press, which didn't really happen before. This was all very polite and cordial and diplomatic in the past, and now it has come out in front page news and has been communicated in a variety of ways, Twitter, things like that, that never happened in the past. And so this idea of burden sharing has come out in a more blunt, crass kind of way. I think under a Biden administration, it would go back to kind of the way it was. It would be an issue that is raised among the allies in polite conversations, but does not come, you know, back to headline kinds of news. Whether or not that's good or bad, I leave it to your listeners to decide. You know, there's been a lot of press about how, under the prodding by President Trump, many or several, at least, NATO nations have increased their defense spending fairly significantly, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. But that's probably the difference we would see there. This administration, you know, admittedly has pushed foreign military sales, and they have done it for a couple of reasons. One is it benefits, you know, U.S. manufacturing and trade, and it also makes our allies stronger partners. And so they, like you said, they are talking about selling the F-35 to the UAE. I personally think that's a good idea. When you look at the biggest challenge in that area, it's Iran. And so the more capable partners you have against, you know, stacking up to Iran it'll constrain Iranian bad behavior. And they are unmistakably the one that we need to worry about in that region. Similarly for Saudi Arabia, and yet this administration has really pushed to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, and even in the light of, you know, allegations of human rights violations and the murder of Khashoggi, which was terrible. But that has not deterred this administration from trying to equip Saudi Arabia to kind of really do their part. And I think that's wise. I mean, you need capable partners if you're going to have an alliance. You can't have this great capability in the United States and then everybody else is having weapons that are not even close to that. So I think that makes sense. I think a Biden administration, though, would be much more skeptical of selling weapons to any country that does not have an impeccable human rights record. And so I think we would see kind of the return of that. You know, there's Democrats in Congress that are already pushing to go slow on the sale of the F-35 to the UAE. And that's kind of the theme they're using. They also talk about, as you mentioned, the need to make sure that Israel has a qualitative edge of the military equipment over anybody else in that region. I don't personally have any worries in that area. I think by virtue of all the other aspects of the Israeli Defense Forces, they are always going to have that qualitative military edge. No matter, you can give somebody the the best equipment in the world in Israel, just because of their culture and their tradition, is going to put it to better use, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting in some respects, and that's maybe a bit of a red herring, that argument in particular. But I do want to go back, because you did mention human rights being an issue for some people with the UAE. And, you know, there are reports that, or in effect, there are suggestions that the UAE stand accused of war crimes in Libya. And so there is at a top level, I would imagine, a difficult decision to be made over the future sale of the F-35. And I just wonder, do you get a sense that despite there being approvals given, will there be any extra due diligence on the part of the government to make sure that either the UAE are encouraged to address those types of issues? Or is it more a case that you can break this down more simply because the bigger problem is that the US and the UAE are allies and it fits their relationship much better to try and stem what Iran is doing? And so in that sense, that's number one, and everything else is secondary to that.
Yeah, with this administration, they have clearly prioritized countering Iran over everything else. And so I suspect we are still talking about concerns we have about the UAE and Libya. We are probably still talking to Saudi Arabia about concerns we have about things they have done in Yemen. But we have not allowed those concerns to kind of derail arms sales. And, you know, personally, I think that's probably the right, you have to put your security first. But I don't think the same token, you can ignore those things and you need to make those part of the discussion. You know, I think under a Biden administration, those topics become much bigger and maybe even to the point of derailing some of these sales. I mean, the Democrats in the Congress have, based on things they have seen in Yemen, have tried to stop essentially all military cooperation between the United States and Saudi Arabia. And it's not been terribly successful, but they keep trying. And so I think that is one of the distinguishing situations. The United States has also been proposing to sell a lot of equipment to Taiwan, and that has greatly irritated China. And I think a Biden administration would be much more sensitive to these concerns that China would have. This administration has pushed on with it.
Okay, and just wanted to touch on the U.S. Army specifically, because I know that's an organization that is very close to your heart. And as I understand it, you were there for 36 years with the Army. You'll know much better than I in terms of their priorities. But on things like Future Vertical Lift with FARA and FLARA, there hasn't been any particular deviations despite the COVID problems, and that still being, more difficult to ignore. And the sense from the Army has always been that getting approvals as and when we need them, we're meeting major milestones, and this is Future Vertical Lift is an effort that is just indispensable. But I just wonder if there's a change of administration. Do you foresee a time where either FARA or FLARA might have to be prioritized for funding reasons, or are those both so far down the track that we can say with kind of some certainty that they're likely to reach fruition, or, the first unit equipped milestones, I think, from 2028 onward?
It's a great question. The biggest threat to both those programs is obviously constrained funding. And even with the Trump administration, their budget forecasts for the next few years don't even keep up with inflation. And so when your budget doesn't keep up with inflation, that puts a loss of buying power on the Department of Defense year over year. And so I know those programs are under a lot of pressure. They really are necessary. I mean, they replace the Black Hawk and they replace the Kiowa Warrior, which they've already retired. And so you can't keep flying the Black Hawk helicopter forever, and they've already gotten rid of the Kiowa. So these are programs, like that you said, don't even come in to procurement for 10 years. And by that time, the Black Hawk will be even older, and the need will even be greater. budget pressures may force them to attack these problems sequentially versus simultaneously. Right now, the Army has an aspiration to essentially procure these platforms at the same time, and they may be under such budget pressure in the future that they have to do them sequentially. And so their first priority is this reconnaissance helicopter. They may have to address that to some degree and then switch over to the long-range assault helicopter just because of the lack of money that they might have in the future.
Okay, and as I touched on COVID briefly, just wanted to kind of get your thoughts more comprehensively on that. So under Trump, the big idea has been to continue Operation Warp Speed, which is effectively using DoD funding to develop a COVID vaccine. Would you imagine that that continues under Biden? I mean, given obviously that it is such a national emergency almost, it is essential.
Yeah, it's a great question. So Operation Warp Speed is the effort by the administration to acquire 300 million doses of a vaccine by January, and it could be multiple vaccines. I had the opportunity to interview General Perna, who's the chief operating officer for the program, last week. Really fascinating. And he confirmed that it would be the same goal under both a Biden or a Trump administration to keep going as fast as possible. And, you know, it's maybe the UK is doing this as well, but it's just so interesting to me that the United States is already buying these vaccines. They have already committed, you know, billions of dollars to buy vaccines, which haven't even been proven yet. They're buying the syringes, they're buying the needles, they're buying the refrigerators, all these things ahead of actually approving vaccines, so that when they do finally get the thumbs up on a vaccine, you know, they will already have all the necessary equipment to transport and administer this vaccine. That will stay the same. Based on what I have heard Vice President Biden say, he shares that goal 100% of that Trump does, to get this vaccine in the arms of as many Americans as possible so that we can get back to a semblance of normality.
And funneling that money to that effort, and of course, if it's from DOD, it's from a DOD budget, does that automatically mean then that projects involved, like equipment or acquisition plans, might go askew, or that some funding might have to be diverted to that, and as a consequence, either readiness suffers or future equipment plans suffer?
Yeah, most of the equipment that has been associated with Operation Warp Speed was given by Congress as a part of the big stimulus CARES Act funding in May of 2020. So that particular effort has not had an impact on defense budgets. There have been other unpaid bills that have kind of been created, you know, so the all of a sudden having to switch the Pentagon over to completely telework, having to change their recruiting models to completely virtual, and having to give money to defense contractors just to keep them going. All those have kind of been unexpected bills to the Department of Defense, which they're going to constrain the DOD in the future. There's bills that they're going to have to pay out of other accounts that will, you know, impact the DOD. I don't think that's going to be huge, but all of them talk about unpaid bills of $5 or $10 billion that they're not quite sure how they're going to pay today.
I just want to finish and round up on the idea of threats. I mean, for many years, and whoever you speak to, whether that be personnel within the Army, the Navy, or, you know, other services, it's consistently mentioned that China and Russia remain obvious threats, and that clearly will continue. Do you expect the tough stance from Donald Trump to remain if he is to continue? And likewise, would it continue with Biden? And if so, what might that mean for, you know, flashpoints like the South China Sea and the Asia Pacific and things like that? And also international agreements. You know, we've seen Donald Trump, I suppose, take a fairly liberal stance to longstanding defense arrangements and partnerships, either by turning them up, like in the case of Iran, or you know, his next move on those things has always been unpredictable. Do you foresee that to be the case with Joe Biden, or how would you read that?
Yeah, great question. And so I think there is a great deal of consensus that wasn't there even a year or two ago on China. You know, and so if you'd have asked a lot of Americans 2 or 3 years ago about China, that you would have gotten a very mixed response. Now, I think with COVID and a few other things that have happened, the crackdown in Hong Kong, most Americans now view China as a threat. And I think between Biden and Trump, I think that's a fairly similar view. They will pursue that goal in different ways. You know, Trump has chosen mostly economic elements of power to kind of push back on China. Biden may try more diplomatic approaches, something like that. But I think both of them share the same worldview. And kind of similarly, Russia. Russia has, you know, because of the, I guess, the scrutiny that President Trump got because of, you know, alleged Russia connections, both of them have kind of moved into this camp of viewing Vladimir Putin as very detrimental to international security with the poisonings of Navalny and Skirkov and his troublemaking in Ukraine. I don't think there is much difference between the two of them on a Ukraine policy. You know, at the end of the Obama administration, they were unwilling to provide lethal support to the Ukraine. And so they provided, you know, blankets or food and stuff like radios. And Trump has provided Javelin anti-tank missiles. I think a Biden presidency would also adopt that kind of view. I think any of our illusions about Russia have gone away. And I think a Biden presidency would contribute, you know, lethal aid to the Ukraine and help train them. Arms control agreements. I mean, you're right. This administration, the Trump administration, has taken a very skeptical view to any agreement that one of the parties is violating. And so, as you kind of mentioned, they got out of the JCPOA because they thought that was a flawed treaty. I think a Biden presidency gets back in that agreement, probably. Everything I've heard says that they are thinking about getting back in it if they win. The Trump administration has been very skeptical to arms control agreements like New START and the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. And I think a Biden administration would be much more favorable to those types of treaties. They like to get into a treaty, and then if there's a problem with it, try and fix it with within. This administration, the Trump administration, has kind of taken a different approach. Get out of it. Get out of a flawed treaty and then try and come up with something better. So really two radical approaches on arms control agreements.
Yeah, we discussed New START specifically in our news round. And I was mentioning that it expires. This is the agreement between the US and Russia. And it effectively determines the number of nuclear warheads that any one country can possess. And it is due to expire in February 2021. So it's almost a pivotal moment for whoever, you know, and they'll take office from January if there isn't any delay. So that might give us a fairly clear indication as to how things are going to proceed with such a, you know, high level decision to be made in and around that time.
No, you're right. Both of them, Vice President Biden, you know, I think he intrinsically favors the agreement. He likes things that constrain the number of nuclear weapons. I think Trump would like to extend New START, but he wants to bring in some other things. He'd like to bring in China, but that's probably not going to happen. But as a minimum, he would like to be able to constrain Russia on their total number of nuclear warheads, because New START just constrains the strategic warheads, and he views their large numbers of tactical warheads as a problem. I think they got really close to an agreement. Maybe now that the election's over, maybe we'll hear something more on that.
Very interesting. Well, Lieutenant General, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. And no doubt you're going to be glued to the television like the rest of us over the next day and a half and beyond to figure out and find out who the next president of the US is. So with that said, we won't leave it another 4 years to catch up with you for sure. But certainly as developments progress, we'll certainly look to reach out and speak with you once again. But for the time being, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to another episode of the Weekly Defence Podcast. As always, a big thanks to everyone who took the time in being with us today. And for our listeners, if you enjoyed the show, make sure you like and subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. Shepherd Media is also offering a 20% discount for annual subscription to premium news. Head over to shepherdmedia.com/subscribe and insert code podcast20 to redeem, which is valid until the 31st of December, 2020. Until next week, thanks for listening.